Amitu Perimeter, who will be now giving a Psy lecture and later on another talk that will be announced later on. So I'm looking forward to hear about space-time, quantum mechanics, and positive geometry.
All right, it's wonderful to lecture again at Psy. Been many times, and I trust you guys are having a great time, and your brain is not yet jelly, although I suppose it's almost jelly by this point. I decided there's just one lecture here, and I would try to have something fit thematically, both with what's going on at this nice little workshop, as well as what Freddie's been talking about and what Oliver will be talking about. But I want to put this sort of general subject of thinking about the physics of scattering amplitudes in a slightly broader context. Really, what's going on, and I think the real interest of the subject is that it forces us to think about some very deep and basic physics having to do with the structure of space-time and quantum mechanics from a different and more invariant point of view. And so I want to spend the first few minutes explaining what the general physical question is, introducing the reason why we think these objects, scattering amplitudes, and a cousin, in fact, a generalization of an important generalization of scattering amplitudes, even more realistic, is something that's pretentiously called the wave function of the universe. That's supposed to be the central object of study in cosmology, ultimately. So I want to talk about what these objects are, why they're interesting, why there is a major intellectual challenge, a really major intellectual challenge, to try to figure out some ab initio new ideas for what determines them, where we don't use the usual pictures of local evolution in space-time and unitary evolution in Hilbert space. Those are the two central principles of 20th century physics that you're spending a lot of your time in the Psi program presumably learning about. But there's lots of indications that we have to figure out some way of thinking about physics where both those ideas don't play such a central role. And thinking about calculating scattering amplitudes and even the wave function of the universe from a different point of view is going to force us into coming to grips with the kinds of ideas that are going to be necessary and is going to force us to confront the kinds of new structures that we should expect to see in order to finally figure out how to replace space-time with something else, perhaps even ultimately how to replace the conventional picture of quantum mechanics with something else. So that's the first part. I'll just give some physical motivation for these questions. Then in the second part, I'll just tell you a little bit about this notion of a positive geometry. It's just something that we've run into in the last 10 years or so, understanding more and more explicitly as time goes on. And it may well be a way, it may very well still be in some quite intermediate stage of development. There might be many other concepts that we have to run into in the fullness of time, but it will already give you an idea of the kind of level of abstraction and the new kinds of mathematical question that we might have to start getting used to if we want to figure out how to do physics without space-time and without a Hilbert space, which is something, as I hope from the first part of the talk, you'll be convinced that we need to do. All right, so that's the plan. So let me just say a few qualitative things in the beginning. The most obvious fact about the world is that there is space and time. Physics is supposed to be, and has been for hundreds of years, about describing how things vary in space as we move through time. And of course, the vast majority of the kind of observations that most physicists do, they sit in labs, even if they're professionals. They sit in grungy basements. They do experiments. They do experiments over finite ranges of space and time. And so they're very happy to do those things. That's 99.99999% of science is about questions where you don't question the existence of space and time. That's very good. A very big part of all of physics and a very big part of a lot of science, of course, also assumes quantum mechanics. There's the Hilbert space. Ultimately, we imagine there's a wave function that lives in some Hilbert space. We have the usual picture for states and probabilities and all of the rest of it. Nonetheless, first for direct kind of practical observational reasons, and later for more conceptual reasons having to do with quantum mechanics and gravity that I will briefly summarize. Theoretical physicists who think about fundamental physics have spent a long time dealing with observables, at least observations, experiments, and then observables that you try to compute from a theory, which don't live in the interior of space-time, okay? Which in one way or another live on the boundaries of space-time. Okay, so the most obvious one of these observables, and as we'll talk about, the one that's still quite poorly understood, but the most obvious of these observables are scattering amplitudes, right? So a scattering amplitude is not something like someone does in a little lab where they get up in the morning, they like do an experiment looking at how things are moving around and having a tracer on the screen or something like that. Scattering amplitudes are the relationship of the experimentalist to the experiment is a little more distant, right? The CERN experimentalist wakes up in the morning, they have this collider 27 kilometers around, they collide these itty bitty particles, the protons that are minuscule, right? And so for all intents and purposes, 27 kilometers is infinity relative to the size of the proton. Okay, so the particles are coming in from, for all intents and purposes, infinity. They bang into each other. Something happens. So I have some particles coming in. They bang into each other. Something happens. And some things go out. If you're doing the LHC, two protons come in, and a whole mess of crap comes out. Okay? All right. So you see, the observation starts and ends at infinity. Is that clear? Right? You know that you're not. No experimentalist is inside the proton to see what's going on. Right? There are these big hulking things. Besides, they're European and enjoying their espresso while all this stuff is happening. Right? They like collide the protons in the morning. They have their espresso. They come back in the evening if you're lucky. Okay? And it's not a weekend or the month of August. And they look at what comes out, right? And they have these histograms and the plots of all kinds of stuff that comes out. Do the particles come out of this angle, that angle? What kind of particles? With what energies and so on? Okay. So the observations begin and end at infinity, at infinite space and infinite time, effectively, certainly relative to the scale associated with the elementary particles. Okay. So it's not an experiment that's done in the interior of space-time. The observations start and end at the boundaries. In this case, it's flat space, right? Because we don't care about cosmology for these questions. So we have flat space-time, and we have observations that begin and end at the infinity. Nonetheless, what is it the job of the theorist to do? And the theorist has been doing this since time immemorial, and more concretely for this question, since Feynman, okay, the job of the theorist is to explain how this process happened. What is this amplitude? And the theorist tells a story. The theorist tells a story that inside the proton are two quarks, or a quark and a gluon, right? And then they hit each other, and then this happens, and then that happens, and then that happens, and then that happens, and all this stuff. And the word is and then and then and then. Because you're giving a causal picture for what happened, right? So there's all this stuff going on the inside, right? You draw every possible picture for how it could happen, because the world is quantum mechanical. That's Feynman's picture, right? You sum over all histories. Every history has some amplitude associated with it. All these pictures are different possible histories that happen in the interior of space-time. We're supposed to add them all up to get the final answer, okay? So you all are experts in this by now. Presumably, okay? At least you shouldn't admit to not being experts in it yet. But so now the particles that come in from infinity, these are real things. There are real things that go click, click, click in an experimentalist detector, or in this case, anti-click as it goes out, right? When they come in, they go click, click, click. So all those lines that escape to infinity are physical particles, okay? All this stuff in the middle is in our head, or in Feynman's head, if you like, okay? This is a story we tell. Even the words are virtual particle, right? And we go at great length, say, well, they're not quite real. What are they? Well, they're part of how we do the computation. Okay, all the stuff that we draw in the middle that happens here is a story we tell to give a local causal and manifestly local, manifestly causal, and manifestly unitary description of the physics. And if you want to make those principles completely manifest, then what you do is invent quantum field theory the way you're learning it. Okay, and that's the whole point of the standard formalism of quantum field theory, is to make causality, and locality go with each other when you have Lorentz invariance. You have Lorentz invariance, causality slash locality and unitarity manifest. I want to stress just a little point here that the Lorentz invariance of the actual scattering amplitude is not the same as causality. Because the actual scattering amplitudes, again, they don't know about the interior here. They just know about the stuff you sent in. You close your eyes, you wait an infinite amount of time, and something came out. Whether those amplitudes are Lorentz invariant, that doesn't by itself tell you that there was something causal or even local going on inside. Lorentz invariance just says if you do a boost on everything, the amplitudes are the same. But I can define the boosts on the asymptotic particles, both at minus infinity and plus infinity, and without saying anything about what happened on the inside. Okay? So now, why were particle physicists, high energy physicists interested in scattering amplitudes? Here it's just a practical, mostly for practical reasons. We're interested in teeny tiny elementary particles, and so we're not small ourselves, so we collide things into each other and they effectively come in and out at infinity. So the experiments, for practical reason, this is the practical reason why particle physicists started thinking a lot about scattering amplitudes, because it's the basic observable that we care about. Okay, now, there's another object. So let's just think for a second, what is the data associated with the scattering amplitude? As you know, we can think about things slightly more symmetrically by imagining all the momenta as incoming, okay? So if I want to give you just the actual data, what labels a scattering amplitude, I have to give you a bunch of four momenta such that p squared equals m squared. Maybe the particles are massless, maybe they're not, it doesn't matter. So, and there's momentum conservation. So at the most hard-nosed level, what is the data then? The data is a bunch of spatial momenta. I can choose a frame and give a bunch of spatial momenta. The energy is determined by the on-shell condition. Okay? And I have the sum of PA equals zero. And I have the sum of the energies associated with PA equals zero as well. And here, there have to be some plus and minus signs for the incoming and the outgoing particles such that it's possible for the energies to add up to zero, right? So there's a plus or minus here depending on whether it's in or out. Okay? Is that clear? All right, so that's the data that labels a scattering amplitude. And again, the experiment starts and ends at infinity. You don't see the interior of the space-time in the actual observation. You see the interior of the space-time and Hilbert space and all the rest of that stuff when you do the calculation, the way we think of the way we present it. But the actual observation does not know about the interior of the space-time. Now let me introduce this another physical object of interest. So scattering up. Before getting there, let me say this is the practical reason we cared about scattering amplitudes. what's the conceptual reason we care about them? The conceptual reason is that if you have quantum mechanics and gravity, you see, when we went from the classical to the quantum picture of the world, we lost a huge number of observables, right? We lost an enormous number of observables. The universe used to be deterministic, then we found out it's not. Okay, so that's why they cried. The classical physicists cried so much. Okay, tough shit. So the world is not deterministic, it's probabilistic. So you can only calculate probability amplitude. All right? But so it's kind of striking that around a little over 100 years, around 100 years ago, we realized that the number of things that we could talk about in physics drastically decreased compared to what we naively thought. Now, if you have quantum mechanics and gravity, the number of things you can talk about gets drastically smaller still. And again, this has nothing to do with theories or formalism for describing things and so on. Just a general piece of advice about your physics life is think as much as possible about physics and as little as possible about formalism. Formalism can be very useful, but you should not tailor what you care about in research by whether there's something pretty or not pretty or good or bad about a formalism. You should always ask whether it's good or bad about some actual physical question. And focusing on the physical questions is a great way to cut through a lot of crap. This is, I think, especially important in a time when we have fewer hints from experiment than we used to. Theorists used to get slapped around by nature all the time, and it's good for us. Okay? And when you don't get slapped around by nature as much, there's a very good tendency for theorists to do what they're very good at doing. It's important to think about some questions where there is a notion of truth and right or wrong, and where you can get slapped around a little, because it's very important to keep ourselves honest. And thinking about physical questions and whether you're making progress in answering physical questions is a good way of doing that. So let's think about what we're allowed to observe when we have quantum mechanics and gravity. Okay, what you're allowed to observe is much fewer things what you're allowed to talk about in any precise way, or much fewer things than with just quantum mechanics alone. Quantum mechanics, in order to allow you to make any precise statement about anything, needs, in its very formulation, it needs two infinities. If you think about it, and good introductions to quantum mechanics will stress these things, although they tend to stress one of them more than the other. First, it's a probabilistic theory. So if you're going to make any kind of precise statement in a probabilistic theory, you have to imagine the ability to do the experiment infinitely often. Okay? So when you make a probabilistic statement that when I toss an unfair coin, you know, a third of the time it comes up head, two-thirds of the time it comes up tails, any probabilistic statement for one event is secretly, and the only precise way it can ever be made sense of, is as a 100 statement of complete confidence for an infinite number of events, right? So if you flip the coin a billion times, then you're saying with very high confidence that two-thirds of a billion times it'll come up heads and one-third it'll come up tails, with a notion of the error. It has to be plus or minus roughly 1/√ of a billion, right, as a fraction. So and as that number billion gets larger and larger, it gets more and more precise. But quantum mechanics, any probabilistic theory, needs you to do the experiment infinitely often. And quantum mechanics also needs you to do the experiment with infinitely large measuring apparatuses. And that's because we can say it in many ways, only in the limit where the measuring apparatus becomes infinitely large do you have perfect decoherence. Only limit where the measuring apparatus becomes infinitely large can you ignore the quantum mechanical fluctuations of the apparatus itself. Again, if you think as operationally as possible, imagine that you want to do any measurement of any sort to an accuracy better than 10 to the power of 10 to the 30 decimal places. Okay, so this is a huge number, but I'm choosing it because you're made out of roughly 10 to the 30 atoms. So if you try to make an experiment with accuracy 10 to the power of 10 to the 30 decimal places, something very bad happens. Okay? 10 to the 10 decimal places, no problem. Keep rolling the grad students and food in, no problem. We'll do the experiment. Right? Even 10 to the 10 to the 20, no problem. But around 10 to the 10 to the 30, something very bad happens. You see, I'm trying to record, you know, the 10 to the 10 to the 30th decimal place of the electron g minus 2. But because I'm made of 10 to the 30 things, with some probability of order 10 to the minus 10 to the 30, I could spontaneously turn into a cloud of dust. That would be very bad for my experiment. Okay? One of the less bad things that could happen is there could be a fluctuation in my brain And even though I was supposed to write down 7 for the 10th of the 10th of the 30th decimal place, I wrote down 2 instead. See, any finite measuring apparatus, so that means that if anyone tells you, you know, there is something you should worry about with probability 10 to the minus 10 to the 40, something truly terrible thing will happen, apart from the fact that it's a ridiculously tiny probability, you can't even allow to worry about it. Because with probabilities get smaller than 10 to the minus 10 to the 30, you might not even exist. You might be a figment of your own imagination. Or that there might be all kinds of other terrible things at that level of probability. So tinier probabilities than that don't make any sense for finite objects. So in order to have perfect precision, you also need to make the experiments with infinitely large measuring apparatuses. So those are two things. You have to do the experiment infinitely often. You have to do them with infinitely large measuring apparatuses. And when, in a world without gravity, no problem. We can do experiments infinitely often. We can do them with infinitely large measuring apparatus, but in the world with gravity, we can't. You see, it's this is one of those things, but maybe I shouldn't say these politically incorrect things, but there's, I think, an awful lot of absolute nonsense, which is talked about the foundations of quantum mechanics, absolute nonsense. And the problem is that it's not that the questions are uninteresting, but they become interesting only when the words gravity and cosmology make an appearance, because that's really where the shit hits the fan and these things actually matter. Okay, so. If those words don't make an appearance, there's nothing funny going on. When those words do make an appearance, there is something very deep and funny going on. In fact, there's something that's that we need to think about and understand going on. And when you have gravity, we can't actually make the apparatuses infinitely big. Gravity does not like this division of the world into an infinite part that's doing the looking and the finite part that's being looked at. And so, if you attempt to make an observation in a fixed size room, and you try to make the apparatus larger and larger, it gets heavier and heavier, inevitably. So that before it becomes infinitely big, it collapses the whole room into a black hole. And that puts a damper on your doing the experiment over and over again, because you get sucked into the black hole singularity and die. So there are two things that happen at the same time. As you try to make the apparatus infinitely big, you just can't do it before collapsing the whole room into a black hole. That also makes it impossible. For the first, the more obvious infinity that we talk about doing the experiment over and over again to happen. Okay, so that's very profound. This is a profound and deep thing. This is a place where this business about needing infinitely large apparatuses and quantum mechanics and so on actually matters for something. It matters when you have gravity, and it tells you something amazing. It tells you there is no precise notion you can talk about for any observation you can do in a fixed size room. Okay? This is probably one of the most profound facts about quantum mechanics and gravity. The fancy way of saying it is that there are no local observables. Okay? But what that means operationally is just what I told you. You cannot even do an observation in a fixed size room, which you can even in principle reduce the systematic error on that observation to 0. Okay? This is extremely important. And so it tells you that what kind of observables can we talk about if we take if we have both quantum mechanics and gravity. The only kind of observables you can talk about when you have quantum mechanics and gravity are where you do the experiments at infinity. Okay, so if you have a space-time that has some asymptotics, like flat space, so you can take the apparatuses and move them, make them larger and larger, but moving them to infinity. And then their only purpose in life is to shoot some particles into the middle of the space-time that bang into each other and come back out where they're measured by infinitely large apparatuses. Those are, in principle, perfectly well-defined observables when you have quantum mechanics and gravity, and the only ones that at least obviously make sense. Okay? So this is extremely important. That means when we went from classical to quantum, we lost a massive number of observables. The world became not deterministic even. Now we have quantum mechanics and gravity. We lose still more observables, right? All the local observables are gone. And the only kind of precise observables that we can talk about only make sense in space-times like asymptotically flat space, where you can have things like scattering amplitudes. So this is the second reason for the importance of things like scattering amplitudes. Not only are they the objects that particle experimentalists like to measure, and which we use to probe, you know, the short distance property of nature for practical reasons, but also in space-times that are at least asymptotically flat, which our universe is a very good approximation to, they're the only kind of precise quantum mechanical observables you can talk about. Right? So that's the second conceptual reason for the importance of a scattering amplitude. Now, those words might sound a lot like holography, right? And in fact, they're the precise, well, they're really, as far as we know today, they're the precise content of the holography, the idea that the observables in gravity live on the walls at infinity. And this is not a new thing. This was appreciated by people who thought deeply about these things already in the 1960s, most notably Bryce DeWitt, but also implicit in a lot of Penrose's work from the 60s was this kind of realization. Now, you all know, and you've presumably had many courses, at Psi already, that in the last 20 years, we found a much more controllable but very toy example of the same phenomenon in another set of space-time. So if we talk about flat space, if you don't know what this Penrose diagram is, this one or that one, don't worry about it. But this is just an actual picture of the tin can geometry of empty de Sitter space. So this is the example par excellence of a geometry where we can talk about what the precise quantum mechanical observables are, and we have a very good idea, although still a lot left to be understood, about how to go about computing them. Physicists love to put things in boxes, and gravity is famously hard to put in a box. Okay? Everything, especially quantum gravity, is very hard to put in a box because everything fluctuates. So empty de Sitter space is the simplest example of a gravity in a box you could possibly imagine, because there is this negative curvature on the inside so that the proper distance to infinity is infinite. However, because of the warping, it still takes light finite time to get to the boundary and bounce back. So in every useful sense of the word, physics in empty de Sitter space is like being on the inside of a box. And so, but because the volumes get infinite as you go out to the boundary, all the stuff that we talked about, apparatuses get to become infinitely big, infinitely separated from each other, and so on, all that stuff is still true. So in empty de Sitter space then, the same logic would tell us that the only observables that we can meaningfully talk about in quantum gravity, quantum mechanics and gravity, are these famous correlation functions. Okay? So you can ping things on the boundary of the box, and they can send waves that go into the middle. They can bang into each other. Maybe they can create black holes or in spiraling solar systems. They can do all sorts of crap, and things come back out. And these are the kind of observables that we can talk about. Okay? So in this case, what lives at infinity is just what lives on the walls of the tin can. The observations start and end at the walls of the tin can. And you can ask then, if the observations start and end at the walls of the tin can, what is the inside of the tin can for? And the answer is just the same as the answer we gave for the Feynman diagram pictures for the LHC experimentalists. It's because that's a rational way of explaining what happened, right? All these waves went in, they banged into each other, they made this, they made that, some other stuff came out. But if you only live on the walls, you could say, gosh, I don't know, that's your story for what's going on. Could there be another story for what's going on? And Maldacena comes along, and many friends say, yes, there is a totally different story for what's going on. There is no inside at all. In fact, there's just this strongly coupled quantum field theory that lives on the boundary, right? So that shows explicitly how you can have two different stories for explaining exactly the same actual experimental observation. If you're the hard-nosed experimentalist, you see, you don't care either way. You're like, oh, whatever. Can you help me compute what happened or not? I don't care how you do it. I just want the answer, right? And is there a reason to prefer this second picture? Well, there is, because there are ultimately questions about dealing with the quantum mechanics and gravity in the interior. Saying that it's gravity in the interior is a very good approximation for many, many questions, but there are lots of questions that we don't know what the answer is. Saying, on the other hand, is a quantum field theory on the boundary is perfectly well defined, and so you're in much, much better shape. I should say that things are still not perfect, of course, because this is a strongly coupled field theory on the boundary, and weakly coupled in the bulk. So the irony of the ADS-CFD correspondence is that conceptually, you're most excited by the fact that you replace gravity by something that's much better understood. Practically, it's always the other way around, almost always the other way around, because you have no idea how to solve the strongly coupled field theory anyway. And you use the bulk to get some picture and a feeling for what's actually going on. With the, so that explains why it's possible to have, you know, 59,000 papers or however many there are, because most of which are in the opposite direction. Okay? Most of them are not using deep facts about the boundary to tell you something about quantum gravity in the bulk, because you can't actually solve the theory. So the experimentalist on the boundary is still not happy. Okay, but still, that it clearly shows that it's possible to get rid of the interior. Okay, and only talk about observations. Now, what's the problem with this picture? Well, first of all, it's not the real world. And here I'm not just bitching. You could say, after all, maybe the radius of curvature is 10 billion light years on the inside. Okay, and then as far as anything other than cosmological questions are concerned, it might as well look the same, right? And of course, you have to find the right background and so on and so forth. But maybe that's doable. That's not so much what the problem is. The problem is not this is some negatively curved space, because you could make it arbitrarily weakly negatively curved if you like. The problems are the questions that we know how to answer are not the questions that you and I care about, even if we were on the inside of this box. Okay, it's the precise observables here live on the walls, and so you get a good you have a good definition for what those observables are, and at least in principle a set of rules for computing them, but they're not the questions that someone naturally cares about in the interior, first. But related, very relatedly, second, ADS-CFT is a wonderful example and the gateway drug into this whole idea that space-time somehow emerges from more primitive building blocks. But it's emergent space and not emergent space-time. It's very important. Okay? It's not emergent time. Time is untouched in this subject. There's a time that flows here on the boundary, and it's exactly the same as the time that flows on the inside. Okay? So in no sense is there a notion of emergent time. If I say it another way, once you're in this mental space of thinking about the anti-de Sitter space, once you know that the observables live on the boundary for these general reasons to do with quantum gravity, you go to the boundary and you say, what does a boundary look like? And it looks like just one lower dimensional space-time. Great. There's a notion of locality, and there's a notion of time. And so if someone asked you, what can you do with that data? That's what the boundary looks like. If someone asks you, what can you do with that data? What kind of question can you ask with that data? It's the data associated with the local quantum field theory, okay? Because there's a good notion of locality, and there's a good notion of time. Now let's ask what happens as we start inching closer to the real world. So closer to anti-de Sitter space than the real world is just flat space. Okay? The analog in flat space of the boundary is now already quite a bit more confusing. Okay? Well, it's clear what we mean by the boundary in flat space. The most obvious thing we mean, when we look out, what do we see? We see a night sky in every direction. We go off, and so there's a sphere that surrounds us at infinity. There's a celestial sphere. Okay, so there's a two-dimensional sphere. Note that already making that choice, when you talk about the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, you can put coordinates on the boundary. Lots of nice things happen on the boundary. And if it's a conformal field theory on the boundary, then the isometries of the bulk and the symmetries of the boundary become nicely identified with each other. Already here at a technical level, there's a little annoyance if I think about the most obvious thing, which is the celestial sphere. Well, what that sphere is breaks translational invariance. Someone else will have a different sphere. Okay? So you have different spheres. They differ by translations, and they don't act in a simple, obvious way on the sphere. You can work it out, but it's not a... So secondly, you know, the space-time is four-dimensional, the celestial sphere is two-dimensional. So there is another notion of time on the celestial sphere, but it's not a normal time, it's a null time. if we imagine that we have massless particles, okay, we have massless particles going in and out to infinity, that the time on the boundary is not a standard time. It's a null time. Okay? Another way of seeing this is in the just the Penrose diagram from Minkowski space, where the boundaries are null. Okay? They're not. They don't have a standard notion of time. So now you can begin to do the same. But you can begin to do the same kind of exercise. You say the observables start and end at infinity for scattering amplitude. Okay? How should I think about them? Well, we gave one way of thinking about them in terms of the celestial sphere, but there are many others. There's nothing particularly deep or important, I don't think, about any one set of coordinates for talking about them. Infinity for Minkowski scattering, or boundary at infinity for Minkowski scattering, is essentially the same as just any way of parametrizing the on-shell momenta of the particles. Any way of parametrizing on-shell momenta. Okay, so for instance, I could just say I have just constrained p's with p squared equals zero. If I'm in four dimensions, I can just use p squared equals zero. I can use spinner helicity variables that Freddy, as I'm sure, told you about. I can use twister variables, which he'll probably tell you about. He hasn't told you about yet. I can use lots of things. I can talk about the celestial sphere. For example, what is this celestial sphere concretely? If I take each one of these lambdas and I choose a frame, and I put a root energy here, and I say lambda is 1z. And if I'm in Minkowski space, lambda tilde is a complex conjugate. So it's root e times 1 z bar. Then I think of that z and z bar as just labeling a point on the Riemann sphere. And that's just where you are on the celestial sphere. Okay? So that's a way of, so that's what the amplitude is. You give me the celestial sphere, and there's a function of these energies of the particles that go out in every direction and what the angles are on the sphere. Okay? If I want time, what do? I Fourier transform with respect to that energy. Then I have a time that lives on the celestial sphere. The fact that I have to choose a frame to define this is the breaking of translational invariance needed in order to talk about who the celestial sphere is and so on. That doesn't make much difference. So thinking so hard about the geometry and this and that, it might pay off for something. But at zeroth order, infinity is just this space, the space of kinematical invariance. Okay. One way or another, the space of just the kinematics for the particles that come in and out of the collision. But you see, in every one of these spaces, there's no obvious notion of locality. There's no obvious notion of time. Okay, so imagine just you're on the, just mentally think about this picture of the celestial sphere. Clearly, somehow, you have to have a process where two things come in at this angle, and they jump out at some other angle. So it's not true that things only interact with each other when they're close by on the surface and so on. Not at all. They can come in far apart and then jump out at totally different angles. There's no obvious notion of locality on the sphere. Okay? And again, there's no obvious standard notion of time. So here, we're repeating the same ideology. When you have quantum mechanics and gravity, we go to the boundaries. Experimentalists measure them anyway, so that's why we cared about these amplitudes to begin with. Theoretically, we know we should care about them. But what could the ab initio question be in this space of kinematical invariance, in the space of just the on-shell momenta of the particles? We have to find some way of asking a question in that space whose answer has all the richness and complexity of the scattering amplitudes in it without ever talking about the interior of space-time or Hilbert space or any of the rest of it. Okay, that's the analogous challenge that we have when we want to think about flat space. And you see why the challenge is so much greater. Because at least here you went to the boundary and you had a normal space. So you didn't have to give up Hilbert space. You didn't have to give up locality. You didn't have to give up time. Okay? So we knew a normal thing to do here. But when we get closer to the real world, we don't know. Now we're asking a question that's almost the real world about the scattering of particles. No experimentalist cares about this question. Many 6,000 experimentalists care about this question. Okay. But now, the main new thing is time. The main new thing is the physics of time. And how, and this was a question people even asked in the 1960s, okay? How is the fact that there's causal local evolution reflected somehow in these observables that start and end at infinity, okay? And what are the rules? And finally, how can you determine them ab initio from some different starting point? Okay, now let me say, this is still a halfway step to the real world, so let me talk about what we ultimately have in the real world. We don't even have flat space. Okay, on very, very large distances, the world is not flat, and it's cosmological. So we actually have... So what is the analog? What is the analog of these observables at the boundary? And once again, there's both a practical question and a conceptual one. But first, let's talk about the practical one. Okay? So remember, we just went over these various reasons the experiment in particle physics, the scattering amplitude experiment, doesn't see the interior of the space-time. But the main reason I give you to begin with before this deeper one to do with gravity was a practical one. The experimentalists aren't teeny tiny, so they can't go in and see what happened in the proton and so on, right? Now, but you could imagine someone else is teeny tiny or some other way of doing it where you might actually see what happened, you know, on the inside, take a movie of what happened and so on. You could at least imagine that. When we finally get to cosmology, we don't even have that luxury. So now there is a very nice collision and concordance between the practical considerations, the conceptual considerations, everything, all land on top of each other. Cosmology is a historical science. You don't do experiments, you do observations, okay? And in any historical science has an interesting relation with the notion of time because none of us were around back then, right? None of us were around early in the universe. We weren't there. We're definitely not doing the experiment again. We're not recreating the condition again to see what happened. So what does it mean when we say this and that happened in the early universe? The early universe was hot. We had Big Bang nucleosynthesis. We produced elements. We did that. There was recombination. There was all. What is that? See, that also is a way of integrating in a history in order to make sense of observations that we do in space today. So the only observations that we can make are at very late times, and they're purely spatial. There's no time involved in them, okay? So if I draw a picture of the geometry, you know, many of you have seen some sort of picture with some conformal time, but very roughly, this is time and this is now. This is a to naught. So we are making measurements on some spatial surface now, okay? And we are inferring a history as a way of explaining, giving a rational explanation with simple rules, a rational explanation for this pattern of correlations that we see in space today. Okay, this is a very obvious fact about any historical science, but I want to stress it. It has nothing to do with anything fancy. It's equally true of a detective. A detective said the person A murdered person B yesterday. Why? Because it explains a correlation in space today that the bullet from the gun belonging to person A is found in the body of person B. Okay, so there is some correlation in space today that you integrate in some history and a past in order to explain. All right. So here too, we really can't avoid the idea that it's in our head because we just can't repeat it. We can't do it again. It happened. Already, and so it's absolutely a sort of construct that we're putting in order to explain the patterns that we see. What are the patterns that we can talk about? Okay, what are the observations we can make? Well, again, the practical and the conceptual converge here. The universe is really big, right? So what's the first thing you're gonna do? You just look out of the night sky and you just catalog things. How many red stars are there? How many yellow stars? How many blue stars? Or what fraction are red? What fraction are blue? What fraction are yellow, right? That's both practically the kind of thing astronomers like to do, but also if we now wanna ask about what kind of questions can we ask where we get to do the experiment infinitely often with infinitely big measuring apparatuses, for that question, then, these are the observations that we have to talk about. Remember, in textbook quantum mechanics, you have to do the experiment over and over and over again. You might be very confused. In the universe, we don't get to do the experiment over and over again. So what gives? How do I make precise quantum mechanical predictions? But the universe itself did the experiment over and over and over again in different causally disconnected regions. And so what we can do as instead of averaging over a sequence of measurements in time is we can average over things in space if the universe becomes infinitely large. Okay? So if the universe becomes infinitely large, you can talk about correlations in space by averaging over space rather than averaging over the number of trials. Is that clear? Okay, this is it's because of some nice accidental things that happen. The universe is basically translational invariant. We don't have something randomly different happening in place to place to place, so that we can get a huge number of effective trials just by making measurements in different parts of space. Now, if you care about the conceptual right to the end, issues in our actual universe, because we're accelerating now, we can't do that. If the acceleration doesn't stop in the next few billion years, if the acceleration keeps going forever, then what we see right now in the universe is what we're ever going to see. We're never going to see anything more. And this is why the questions about the accelerating universe bring to the fore the hardest conceptual problems in physics, okay? Because nothing is infinite. We don't have access to an infinite amount of stuff. What we see in the universe now is what we're ever going to see. All of those crutches you need, all those things that quantum mechanics demands in order to make precise predictions about the world, infinitely large measuring apparatuses, doing the infinite experiment infinitely often, cannot happen in an accelerating universe. There are no precise quantum mechanical observables that we can talk about in an accelerating universe. Okay? So this is a humongous problem. I think it's very likely the deepest question in physics. I personally think we're not within decades of knowing how to even approach it properly, although it might be that might be a little pessimistic. If you asked me 20 years, 15, 10, 10 years ago, I would have been more optimistic about it. But let's ignore that for now. Okay, so that's quite a bit further down the line. And anyway, the magnitude of errors that we're talking about, they're of order e to the negative the entropy of our de Sitter space. So they're of order 10 to the minus 10 to the 120, which are definitely smaller than the 10 to the minus 10 to the 30 that you and I have any right to complain about. Okay, so let's forget about that and just imagine a more normal cosmology, which eventually opened up into an infinitely large flat space. Okay, so if you have a cosmology like that, which our universe is huge, so again, to a very good approximation, it's like that. Then what are the kind of observations we can make? There are spatial averages. Okay, there are spatial averages, and these are called cosmological correlations. Cosmological correlators. So again, I remind you. When you're in flat space, we have a scattering amplitude. So we have some scattering amplitude that depends on a bunch of momenta. And these momenta, there's many ways of labeling them. Maybe it also depends on the spins of the particles. Okay, but that is the data. And in the end, the hard-nosed thing is a bunch of momenta, spatial momenta, that add up to zero, and also the energies add up to zero. Okay, so that's the data associated with a scattering process. And again, you have to choose a sign here for who's in and out. Okay, for the energies to be able to add up to zero. Okay, now what are the observables we can talk about in cosmology? Well. As I said, the most zeroth order things are what you can call these one-point functions. So they're like the average, the fraction of stars that are red, the fraction that are blue, and so on. The more interesting things involve correlations. Okay? And so, for instance, you probably all know that the last 20 years of experiments in cosmology have gloriously measured everything about the spectrum of density perturbations in the cosmic microwave background. Okay? So what do people do? What do people literally do? They measure a difference in temperatures at two spots on the sky. Okay, so there's a delta T over T, and it depends on where you are. Here I'm pretending that I have full three-dimensional information. I don't. We only have measurements that we see from this surface of last scattering, this two-dimensional sphere. So really, this is a function of some unit vector on the sky. But this is really a proxy for a spectrum of density perturbations that does depend on full three-dimensional position. Okay. So let's say I have that. But what do the experimenters literally do? So, you know, they literally make one of these maps. You see these beautiful W-colored W maps with hot and cold spots. Looks more or less random, okay? But then what do? When they talk about measuring a two-point function, when they say there's delta T over T, delta T over T, let me do it directly in terms of delta rho over rho, what does this average mean? Again, there's one universe. This is not an expectation value in the sense of quantum mechanics where you do the experiment over and over. So do you know what they actually do? What do they actually do? When they talk about two-point functions in cosmology, do you know what they actually do? If you've had a course on this, did someone explain what they actually do? What does that average sign mean? What they literally do is pick a spot and another spot with a fixed vector separation between them. Right? If I take this literal spot, I get delta over T is minus, you know, 1.7 times 10 to the minus 5. Over here, it's plus 2.3 times 10 to the minus 5. Okay? For these particular points, there's some random numbers. What you do is you average that product over all the points on the sky with that separation fixed. Okay? That's what that average sign means. So this average sign gives you a function of x minus y, and it's what you get by actually averaging over all the spots in the sky with that separation fixed. Okay? And in fact, even to do it practically, the experimentalists do it practically to find it convenient to go to Fourier space, because it's very easy to do these averages in Fourier space, because in Fourier space, you just take the product of the different, because translational invariance is easy to see in Fourier space. Okay? So in fact, so what is the data that labels a cosmological correlator? I can have a two-point function, I can have a 10-point function. Okay? The data that labels a cosmological correlator is delta rho over rho x1 up to delta rho over rho some xn in general. I can go to Fourier space, and I have some function of k1 up to kn, again, a bunch of spatial momenta, with translational invariance just tells me, let me call them p. Translational invariance tells me that there's a delta function for the sum of all the p's. Okay. So those are the observables in cosmology. There is a collection of functions that depend on spatial momenta. Again, you have to tell me the analog of the particles you're scattering is which average are you taking, delta rho over rho, some other quantity, right? Once you choose the quantity, then you just get a function that depends on a bunch of spatial momenta that add up to zero. Okay? So the way a cosmologist would represent, so the last 20 years of experimental cosmology has been about measuring in great detail the two-point function. The next 20 or 30 years, people are going to try hard to measure nonlinearities, beginning with the three-point function. There's been a lot of theoretical work on this, but also lots of it's a big goal for the experiments, ultimately, is to be able to get down to a level where you could measure the non-Gaussianities, the three-point function, if you believe inflation. There's a very detailed shape of the three-point function that's predicted, which you could hope to measure, and it's vaguely conceivable that they could get down to that level of measurement. At least if the scale of inflation is high enough, the size of the effect should be large enough that the experiments on the 20 or 30 year timescale should be able to see them. But the way a cosmologist would represent, let's say, a three-point function is they would draw a triangle, right? They would say it depends on three momenta, p1, p2, p3, that add up to zero, right? The way they'd represent the four-point function is a quadrilateral, right? p1, p2, p3, p4, and so on. Okay, so for all of these polygons in the sky made out of a bunch of spatial momenta that add up to zero, you get a number, and that's the observable, right? That's the observable at infinity. That's the holographic observable. Any fancy word you want to say for it. The analog of the scattering amplitude in flat space. The analog of the boundary correlators in empty De Sitter space are these functions of spatial momenta on the future spatial boundary as the universe becomes infinitely big in cosmology. Okay? Is that clear? Now, notice there are many things about this that are already less familiar. For instance, when you have an S matrix, there's control of the initial state, and you measure a final state. There's no control in an initial state here. We don't know. The universe happened once. All we get to do is measure these correlations late in time. That's all the information we have. Once again, you can ask the question, how do we practically compute these things? Again, you know, if you're calculating ADS correlators with some weakly curved ADS geometry with the ADS length is larger than the Planck length in the bulk, you just use Feynman diagrams in the interior. And apart from esoteric questions about making black holes and things like that, you'd get the right answer. The boundary is strongly coupled, but it's good for giving you firm answers to those esoteric questions. Okay? Now, when we move to something closer to the real world, when we're talking about scattering amplitudes, again, we can, in principle, if the couplings are weak, we can calculate using Feynman diagrams. Okay? And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But we are inspired to think whether there's some other way of doing the calculation where we don't have the inside of the space-time. And finally, when we come to cosmology, now we weren't even there in the past. Okay? So first of all, the conventional way of doing all these calculations, and you know, there's an answer if you believe in inflation, for example, for literally these observables. If you believe in inflation, the physics was very weakly coupled. So Feynman diagrams and perturbation theory are a very good guide to doing these computations. First of all, no one was around back then. And secondly, we know for many good reasons, the whole notion of time breaks down eventually as you get in the very early universe. So there it's not even a luxury. It's not like eventually this notion that there's a time in which we're using to integrate forward cannot be a precisely correct one. So the only thing we have access to are these measurements at the end, and we should try to find a theory that computes them. Now, ab initio, without talking about time. Okay, so that's the general goal. And so we've gotten much closer to the real world. The fundamental new ingredient is time. Okay, and here when we're in flat space, when we go to the boundary, it's, as I stressed already, it's weird. It's not a familiar space. It's just a space of on-shell momenta. Maybe there's a notion of null time. It's a kind of a null boundary. There's no obvious notion of locality. There's no obvious notion of time. Okay. Now we go to cosmology. One step further, even worse. It's just space. Of course, there's no notion of time. It's just space. Right? All we have are access to a bunch of these spatial momentum vectors. That's it. That is a space. Or so. What kind of question could you ask in this space? Whose answer is these interesting cosmological correlators, right? So that's the challenge that we have before us. Okay, we have these new interesting boundaries where time plays an important role in defining the physics. We go to the boundary of flat space. We go to the boundary of the deep future spatial service in cosmology. And we would like to know, in these cases, do we know any good ab initio rules for what kind of consistency conditions the observables should satisfy? Is there anything that ab initio determines them without talking about the interior picture of the evolution? And secondly, how do we go about actually determining them? To beat the dead horse for the last time, we do know it's a good set of ab initio rules on the boundary in empty De Sitter space because it has a notion of locality and time. Those are exactly the things that are missing when we talk about flat space scattering amplitude and we talk about cosmology. So at least I have defined the first two words in my title. The last two words in the title. But let me just tell you a little bit. I won't go on for too much longer, but let me just tell you a little bit about the kind of the kinds of structures that we have started to see that could be relevant to these questions. First, before doing that, I want to tell you another general fact, which is mathematically very easy to establish, but is physically extremely cool, which is the following. It's not at all obvious. I mean, at first blush, it's not at all obvious. Scattering amplitudes, these functions of momenta, let me forget about the spins and so on. Flat space scattering amplitudes. So, you know, here's a very zeroth order thing, right? If we forget about all this fancy stuff, we know that there are some particle physics, some elementary particle physics that controls things we understand. And we use the same old elementary particle physics to calculate, you know, the abundance of light elements in Big Bang nucleosynthesis, right? So there, the ultimate observation is cosmological, but we use the particle physics to do the calculation. We don't get all bent out of shape about all these fancy things without any problem. We use the local physics to do all the calculation. So clearly, oh, and I should have said one last thing before getting there. The object that calculates these cosmological correlators is called the wave function of the universe. And that's the pretentious name for it, okay? But it's just a way. If someone just handed you all the cosmological correlators, you'd be done. They could hand you the wave function as an intermediate step like we always do in quantum mechanics. So a wave function would give you the likelihood for some particular configuration in space, and then you would mod square it and integrate over all the configurations consistent with what you see with that mod squared to get the actual probability or the correlation function. Okay, so the wave function of the universe is just a device to calculate these cosmological correlators. Okay, so clearly the particle physics, the underlying particle physics, somehow, even in the most naive way, determines the wave function of the universe, right? Because there's the actual particle physics going on, and it's the microphysics that determines what we end up seeing in the end. So that would make you think that somehow the information about the, let's say, the flat space scattering amplitude, which largely determines the particle physics, somehow the information about the flat space scattering amplitude should be found inside the wave function of the universe, or inside these cosmological correlators. On the one hand, it sort of clearly is. On the other hand, it seems very weird, right? Because one question is very dynamical. You collide things, something goes in, something goes out. The other question is totally static, right? I just have this, make these observations in the deep, deep future. But in fact, it's true. And the scattering amplitudes are properly contained inside cosmological correlators. This is a very deep and simple but beautiful point. So let me be less specific here. So the scattering amplitudes are contained inside cosmological correlators. Let me begin to try to convince you. So let's say a cosmologist is measuring a four-point function. So they would say it depends upon p1, p2, p3, p4. That's how a cosmologist would draw it. But a particle physicist could draw it as p1, p2. Goes to minus p3 minus p4. It's exactly the same data, right? It's a bunch of momenta that are adding up to zero. So another way of saying it is that both problems have a spatial translational invariant. And so what defines the object in both cases is a collection of three vectors that add up to zero. Okay? It's just that the scattering amplitude has one more constraint on it. What is the constraint the scattering amplitude has? The energies have to add up to zero as well. Okay? Now, how does this happen in practical computations? You don't need to know anything in detail about how to do these calculations of cosmological correlators, but just to give you an idea, you know, let's say we're computing some four-point amplitude in field theory, just something like that. How do we get? Where do these delta functions? There's a delta function in space that comes from translational invariance. This delta function in time, in energies, right? This comes from time translational invariance. So where does this come from? This comes from a computation which is back in position space is an integral over all times, right? There's something like that when you do the all the waves going to infinity. coming in from infinity, going out to infinity, have an e to the I et associated with them. So when it, so when you integrate over time, this gives you the delta function. Now, what do you think happens when you do the analog of this question in cosmology? So this was for like a scattering process like this. Here, the analog would be a diagram that looks like that. And now all the legs are being evaluated. We work in momentum space for spatial momenta, but we work in time for time because we don't have time translational invariant. Okay? So we have exactly the same thing. The spatial part is the same, but now we have an integral dt e to the I e1 plus e4 t. And the integral goes from minus infinity to zero. It's cut off somewhere. Okay? Doesn't go all the way because the problem isn't translation invariant. I'm measuring it at a given time. Now, these two integrals, so this is what we get for an amplitude. So this is for an amplitude. Exactly the same integral, minus infinity to zero, dt e to the I, e1 plus e4 t, is what I get for cosmology. And so the functions are very simply related to each other. One of them is a delta function in energy. And what's the other one? So this one gives me a delta E1 plus E4. This one gives me 1 over E1 plus E4. Okay. So you see, now this is something in the amplitudes world you will see over and over and over again. There is there's a very interesting connection between real and analytic objects. Okay? Delta of x is the real cousin of 1 over z. Okay? Delta of x is something if you integrate against f of x, you get f of 0. 1 over z is something if you contour integrate around z equals 0, you get f of 0. Okay? They're totally different, but one of them is an analytic counterpart of the other. Step function of x. What is the counterpart of that? Like log z. Okay? The derivative of this is this, the derivative of that is that, and so on. Okay? So that's what we're getting here. We get, instead of a delta function in energy, we get a pole in the sum of all the energy. Now, these energies are not physical energies of any particle. So by energy there, I might literally mean root k squared plus m squared. Okay? So the cosmological correlators for physical spatial momenta, where all these energies are positive, there's nothing. I mean, that there's no clue of the underlying S matrix. But these correlators have to have an amazing property that if you take the momenta and analytically continue them, so some of the energies are allowed to be negative, then you should be able to encounter and access this pole. Now, what happens when you sit on that pole? As you approach that pole, you take these cosmological correlators, in the physical region, there's nothing happening. But you analytically continue the momenta now, so some of the energies can be negative. You have to choose which ones are negative and which ones will stay positive. So you choose some of them to be negative, some of them to be positive. But as you approach this pole, it's blowing up. What do you think the residue on that pole is of the cosmological correlator? What could it possibly be? It's the flat space S matrix, the flat space scattering amplitude, right? Because as you approach that pole, now, As far as the data is concerned, it looks exactly like the data of a scattering amplitude. Okay, so that's a very obvious, nice thing it could be. Also, it's pretty clear just from these integrals what's going on. You see, the reason there is a pole here is that the sum of these energies goes, when the sum of these energies is non-zero, this integral becomes oscillatory as you go to a large negative time. And so it doesn't diverge, right? However, if I make the sum of these energies zero, nothing is cutting this integral off. And that's where the infinity comes from. But you see, the infinity, the divergence is coming as this time goes more and more and more to minus infinity. That means this vertex is going further and further away from the boundary. But in the limit, it's going so far from the boundary that it doesn't know the boundary's there. If it doesn't know the boundary's there, you're calculating a scattering amplitude. Okay? So this is quite remarkable. The wave function of the universe and cosmological correlators are the observable we can talk about in the actual real world, okay? Not even scattering amplitudes. So that what we really want to talk about the actual real world, all we have left in these any precise sense are these cosmological correlators. But it's not like it's some radically different object. We've got to forget about everything and learn about them. It's a one variable generalization of scattering amplitude by precisely a single variable, the sum of all these energies. Okay? You take a scattering amplitude, whatever they are, all these spectacular things, and there's a way of extending all of these objects by adding a single stinking variable, which now turns them into things that that are, in principle, observables that you could measure and think about in cosmology. Okay? So there's a close relationship between these two sets of problems. If they're both labeled by on-shell data, there's just a little bit more, which has to do with the energy conservation condition for scattering amplitude. But these are the objects of interest. Time is the most fundamental new ingredient. The boundary does not have any notion of locality and any notion of causality and no standard notion of time evolution. And in these spaces, we have to learn what new kinds of mathematical questions to ask, whose answer spits out scattering amplitudes for flat space and spits out cosmological correlators in cosmology. All right, so I think I didn't have any time to tell you about what kind of questions those might be, but at least I hope I gave you some motivation for why they're important questions and why it's not a technicality. This is not a technical subject. I mean, there's a lot of technical work involved in it, but it's most fundamentally a conceptual subject, and it's an adventurous subject because we don't know the rules. I want to really emphasize this point again because it's sort of ironic. We know the non-perturbative rules for fancy schmancy things like Euclidean conformal field theories, right? You want to do Euclidean conformal field theory? It's a hard math problem. Someone comes to you and say, I've solved Euclidean conformal field theory. Here's a spectrum of dimensions and OPE coefficients. You can go check if they're right or wrong. Great, I'll go check, right? It's a hard, beautiful math problem, but the rules are 100% well-defined. Also has very little to do with reality, right? So it's very interesting. The further you are from reality, the better defined the rules are. The closer we get to reality, the less well-defined the rules are. Okay? So we know the rules for fancy schmancy Euclidean conformal field theory, but we don't know the rules. Let's say tomorrow I come in and tell you, here's the S matrix for the real world, for the standard model. I hand it to you, right? Here it is. Do you think we know how to check if it's right or wrong? Really, in precise detail. We do not. Believe it or not, to this day, we don't know what the consistency conditions are for encoding this question of what causal unitary evolution in the interior of the space-time looks like, how it's encoded in the actual scattering amplitude. We know a little bit about it. We know that, so we know how to check if something is unitary. So let's say I hand you a matrix. I can check is S dagger S 1 or not. Great, that's a check. S dagger S equals 1, fantastic. I know how to check if the matrix is Lorentz invariant. Is it only a function of, P squared or PI dot PJ. Great, yes, check. So you would naively think that that's very hard, must be very hard, therefore, to come up with a matrix that's unitary and Lorentz invariant. That's what all this tough stuff is about, okay? Let me just ask you to do the following exercise over lunch just to see how trivial it is, right? I'm gonna give you, here's a non-perturbative unitary Lorentz invariant S matrix. And it'll be a good exercise in what you've learned about field theory to both verify what I'm saying, and then I'll say in a moment what the difficulty is. So let's say you have phi to the fourth theory. And even here, we say this amplitude normally is minus I lambda or something like that, right? If this coupling is lambda. Okay, now, if you've had good lecturers, they will tell you that there's a one-loop correction to this. And the one-loop correction looks something like lambda squared log, and it has some UV divergence. That doesn't matter so much. The interesting part is something that looks like this m squared minus s downstairs. Okay? Are you familiar with formulas like that? Okay, now, if you've had good lecturers, they'll tell you it's very important there's a log there, very magical and very important there's a log, because the imaginary part of this amplitude has to give you the cross-section for producing the things that occur in between. And that's why when s gets larger than m squared or 4m squared or something like that, when s is smaller than 4m squared, nothing is happening. When s gets bigger than 4m squared, this log has a branch cut, and the discontinuity across the branch cut, the imaginary part, gives you the cross-section for a particle production, right? And then plus dot, dot, dot. So there it looks like you have to somehow have these fancy loop integrals and things like that for unitarity. That's the usual logic, right? That's why quantum field theory is hard, because it's Lorentz invariant and unitary at the same time. And many ways of saying that, you write S equals 1 plus IT, and then you have to satisfy something like T minus T dagger I blah blah equals blah T dagger T optical theorem, et cetera, right? Okay, great. Now, let's say you're a dumb guy. You should always be a dumb guy before you do anything smart. Okay, so if you're a dumb guy, you would say, you'd say, I'm not as dumb as this. I'm trying to make something unitary. Why would I write it as 1 plus IT? That's moronic. It's like if I'm trying to make a phase. Why would I write it as 1 plus I something? I'd write it as e to the I something if I want to make a phase, right? So why am I approximating the S matrix as 1 plus IT? Here, I'm just going to write it as e to the IO. Screw you, right? I'm done. It's e to the IO, O is Hermitian. I'm done. Now, furthermore, I want it to match this phi to the fourth theory result. Fine, I'll put in lambda there. And who is this operator O? This operator O is something that takes two incoming states into two final states and just gives me one. Okay? I'm done. That's a beautiful Lorentz invariant operator. Perfectly fine. I've defined all of its matrix elements. Right? Sum of the PI. I've defined all of its matrix elements. When I expand this S to first order in lambda, it gives me the right answer. But I've just constructed it so it's unitary and it's Lorentz invariant. Okay? So why aren't I done? What is all this fancy business about loops? Does anyone know what's wrong with this theory? What do you think is wrong with it? Why isn't this the answer? Screw these guys with their imaginary parts and logs and loops and all that crap. So what is wrong with this? What's wrong with it is that there is no way to get this S matrix by anything that comes from causal evolution. It's acausal. It's Lorentz invariant, it's unitary, but it's not causal. And there are many ways of showing this. But since I've run so far over time already, let me just say what the keyword is. But this shows why all these things matter, you see. The keyword that people started talking about in the 60s is that somehow causality is reflected in the analytic structure of the scattering amplitude. The scattering amplitudes need to be sufficiently analytic. Not totally analytic, but they can't be horribly non-analytic. They should have the property that they're basically analytic everywhere. At most, they have some singularities on the real axis, branch cuts, and so on and so forth. Okay? That fact, where does that come from? That comes from experience from much simpler things that people talked about in the 1800s already of causality for a two-point function. So let's say you have a two-point function, a propagator, which has a property in time space that it's causal. So it's zero before it's some time, and then it's non-zero after some time. That simple fact that it's causal, so it's very non-analytic in time, extremely non-analytic in time, it means that it is very analytic in energy domain. Okay? So if you Fourier transform into energy, anything that has this magic feature of being zero for a while, and then only non-zero after some critical time, any function you get has to have the property that it only has singularities on the real axis, no singularities in the upper half plane, and is exponentially bounded at infinity. Okay? So there's something about analyticity for two-point functions that encodes causality. There's something about analyticity in energy that encodes causality in time. Now, what people hoped for in the 60s is that they'd be able to extend this to higher point functions, four-point functions, higher point functions. Okay? And we know a little bit about what causality means for the S matrix for 2-to-2 amplitudes, for example, by taking a limit that almost makes it the same as a two-point function. So if you take a limit where, let's say, you go to very, very forward scattering and very, very high energies, then even though it's 2-to-2, you're essentially making it a propagation of one particle in a background set up by the other. Okay, so effectively, you take what's a 2-to-2 scattering amplitude and you turn it into a question of a two-point function. In that limit, we can say something about, we can import this knowledge about the analyticity to say something about the analytic structure of the S matrix. Beyond that, we don't know. Okay, and beyond that, and so when, when uh, so, but we don't know in detail. We can stare at Feynman diagrams and do calculations in perturbation theory and get some idea of what the analytic structure is, but we don't a priori know what the analytic structure is. And now let me jump back to this example. So you see, the right answer, it's something that's pretty analytic. It has a log sitting there, okay? Now, what do you think you get from this S matrix if I expand to order lambda squared? And this is a thing that'll be a nice exercise for you to see if you've learned your basic field theory right. This is to work out what are the Feynman rules associated with this stupid S matrix. And the Feynman rules are exactly the same as the usual Feynman rules with one very important difference. All the internal loop propagators are just on shell, just put flat out on shell instead of. So in other words, all the internal propagators are positive energy delta of p squared minus m squared rather than 1 over p squared minus m squared. OK, that's it. That's the only difference. Otherwise, you draw the same diagrams. Everything is exactly the same. But so what do you get then for this amplitude instead of minus lambda squared log from this dumb theory? What you get is minus lambda squared step function of 4m squared minus s. Or actually, s minus 4m squared. Remember I told you step function of x is like the real non-analytic cousin of log x. So you see, that's exactly what you expect, right? If I'm putting the internal particles on shell, the amplitude is 0 until you make them, and then it's 1, and it turns on. So that's what the step function is doing, right? This is horribly non-analytic. Okay? This is horribly non-analytic. And of course, if you look at it in more detail, it's not crossing symmetric. It doesn't have all the other properties that we expect from of good field theory amplitudes. But all those things, analyticity, crossing, all these things are reflecting causality in an important way. If we didn't care about causality and just Lorentz invariance and unitarity, it's a dime a dozen, and completely stupid things work. Okay? So that's why it's very important to figure out how is causality imprinted in the S matrix. Even more important to figure out how is causality imprinted in the wave function of the universe, right? And so you can ask, do we know ab initio what the rules are? What precise analyticity properties should they have, and so on? The answer is no. Even in perturbation theory, to this day, we don't know the answer to this question. Okay? Even something as basic as crossing symmetry. Do we know why crossing symmetry is true? No, we don't. Now, I mean, there are some kind of very, to my taste, very technical proofs of crossing given by some mathematical physicists, but not very particularly illuminating at all. And it's certainly not true for all the cases of physical interest. So even for something as incredibly well-studied as scattering amplitudes, we don't know the answer to this question, this physical question, this question the experimentalist might ask, right? I got my espresso. I came back and looked at my histograms of the spray of all the crap that came out. Prove to me that what happened inside had a causal interpretation, right? And what's the best we can do? The best we can do is to find the right model. We say, oh, here's what's going on. It's a standard model, quarks, and we get the same answer you get. OK, and I have to be pretty impressed with that. OK, that's very nice. But they say, could you tell me more invariantly? Let's say you didn't. What feature of my data, what feature of the answer is telling me? And we don't know precisely how to tell them. We know roughly the analytic structure, et cetera, but we don't know precisely. In the 60s, they hoped that they would be able to derive these rules, but they failed. And the main novel strategy that we have today is not to try to derive them. That's the whole point, is not to try to derive them, but to search for very different kinds of interesting mathematical questions in the space of kinematics, in the space of the boundary, in the space of the on-shell data for scattering amplitudes, and in the space of spatial momenta for the wave function of the universe. These spaces seem as arid and boring and dry as possible. So it's very hard to imagine the kind of questions you would ask there that could produce answers that are as rich and complex as what we see in the physics of scattering amplitudes and the wave function of the universe. And that's what the second half of this talk was supposed to be about, to actually tell you what kind of questions you ask in those spaces. And that's the words positive geometry have to do with the fact that in these spaces, there's not much you can do. You don't have locality. You don't have time. All that's left are very primitive, almost combinatorial things that you can do in these spaces. The remarkable thing is that combinatorial notions and some interesting notions of positivity turn out to put enough rich structure on the space to produce the answers in many toy examples we've understood well for answers of this form. So anyway, I'll stop there. I just hope to have whetted your appetite for why this is an interesting subject. It's deeply physical. it's not, there's a lot of technical work because there's a lot of theoretical data, but unlike a lot of other things that are, you should avoid this field if you want to have rules. If you want to have well-defined rules and work in a well-defined framework, you should not work on the subject. I think, or there are many other aspects of it that you could work on, but there are other more rewarding things to do with your life. If you have a thirst for a certain kind of intellectual adventure to discover what the rules are, for things that have to do with nature, really actual simple questions experimentalists care about, and we should care about too, then this is a fascinating subject, and I encourage you to work hard on whatever problem sets Freddie and Oliver give. All right, thanks a lot.